Welcome back to the True Crime Fan Club podcast. I'm your host, Lainey. Wisconsin is home to some of the most notorious serial killers, Ed Gein, Jeffrey Dahmer, and David Spanbauer. One man would join their ranks in 2009. He was able to have a 21-year crime spree, committing vicious rapes and murders, going virtually undetected. He was the Milwaukee Northside Strangler. Okay. On to the show. Walter Ellis was born in Holmes County, Mississippi, to Leroy and Maddie Ellis on June 24, 1960. Not much is known about his early childhood or when the family picked up and moved to Milwaukee, Wisconsin. What we do know is that he was very troubled as a youth. Neighbors recalled seeing Walter beat up neighborhood children with no remorse. Children ran past his house in order to avoid him and his hair trigger temper. At the young age of 14, he was charged with attempted murder and robbery. There was no conviction in the charges. Due to him being a minor, his record is sealed, so we don't know the specifics of his charges. As time passed, Walter grew out of his violent temper and into a surprisingly quiet young man. He no longer terrorized his peers. Instead, he became affable and even well-liked. This change in demeanor was a welcome relief to his neighbors. Walter was 19 when his first recorded crime took place. He was caught after robbing a home and charged with felony burglary in November of 1978. He was given just 4 years of probation. From 1979 until 1980, Walter would have brushes with the law, ranging from solicitation to drug offenses, gaining an additional 2 years of probation. Almost 2 years to the date of his first felony conviction, he was tried and convicted for intent to distribute a controlled substance. This was a violation of his probation, and he was sentenced to just 3 years in prison, with 1 year probation upon release. Listeners, what you will learn about Walter Ellis is that he gets away with a lot. Throughout 1985, he would have brushes with the law for various offenses that would either add to his probation or be dismissed altogether. He would not spend any meaningful time in jail during this time period. His crimes would finally escalate to murder on October 10, 1986. He picked up 31-year-old Deborah Harris, a sex worker. Their time together started off fun, drinks, drugs, and sex. Then it took a turn. It's not clear what led Walter to snap. He just did. He wrapped his hands tightly around her neck and kept them there until her life slipped away. He drove towards North Ember Lane and dumped her body in the Menomee River. Her body would be found the next day. He must have felt odd, always coming close to killing someone, but never following through with the act. He craved more, which is why on October 11th, the very next day, he picked up 19-year-old Tanya Miller. She too was a sex worker. When she accepted a ride from Walter, she had no idea that her life would end that night. The same events must have taken place. Fun, drinks, drugs, and sex. Walter strangled her like he did Deborah Harris and dumped her in between an abandoned house and a garage. When Detective Bill Vogel and his homicide unit found Tanya's body near the 2100 block of North 28th Street on October 12th, he knew he had a serial killer on his hands. The body of Deborah Harris, whose murder Vogel was also investigating, had the same imprints on her neck. When he expressed his theory to his supervisor, he was chewed out. Wisconsin had just brushed the crimes of Jeffrey Dahmer under the rug. They didn't need another serial killer tarnishing their state. The two murders he committed only satiated him for a little while. Between the years of 1987 through 1992, he committed no more murders that we are aware of. He did, however, begin to play the system to his favor. In May of 1992, he was released on good behavior after only serving 1.5 years of a 2.5-year sentence. In November of that same year, he was arrested for violating his probation, and because he had previously been convicted of federal drug charges, he was assigned to a halfway home, a transitional place where ex-prisoners can learn to reintegrate into society while still being closely watched by law enforcement. It was here that Walter found a friend and halfway house worker, Carl Porter. Walter had recognized him from his latest prison stint. He quickly befriended Carl after hearing from other residents that he could be bribed. In order to leave the halfway house, residents had to use passes and write their name down on a pass list. This was so law enforcement could keep track of the residents' whereabouts. If a resident were to bribe Carl, they would leave the house without Carl documenting that they had been gone. Essentially, they were off the grid. This system worked for Walter. His time was always accounted for, which meant he always had an alibi. Just a few weeks into his stay at the halfway house, he went on an unrecorded pass. It was then that he ran into Irene Smith. He approached her and offered to buy her time. She agreed and was later found stabbed in the neck and strangled. Walter left her body close to his family's home in a trash cart. And we will see this pattern time and time again with him. He will remain in areas he's familiar with, often looking for a location where he knows there will not be much foot traffic. He was done with the halfway house by now. He was growing tired of bribing Carl and was ready to move on. On December 13th, 1992, he left the home for good. 2 days later, he would be arrested for leaving the halfway house without permission and for failing to return. During Walter's interrogation with police, he ratted out Carl. He offered the detectives his services as a confidential informant. He would tell them which houses, accepted bribes. Surprisingly, his offer was accepted. He worked as a CI for the next few weeks, feeding information to law enforcement. He was eventually able to help authorities bring charges against Carl Porter and another halfway house worker. In February of 1993, his probation was cut short due to his cooperation with police, and he was now able to enter his most deadly years. What is interesting about Walter is that he has periods where he's not getting into any trouble. He would be in a dormant state, if you will, for the remainder of 1993. In October 1994, he resurfaced with a vengeance. He met 32-year-old Karen Kilpatrick, who periodically used sex work to make ends meet. She was found in the same alley as Irene Smith. The alley where both women were found runs behind his mother's home. Karen's boyfriend, Curtis McCoy, would become a prime suspect in her murder. A young man who was living with Karen and Curtis at the time stated he witnessed the couple arguing, and he saw Curtis drag her down the stairs and into his van. The evidence against Curtis McCoy was overwhelming. Karen's own 5-year-old daughter corroborated what the young man said in court. Curtis's defense attorney wanted to present evidence that there was likely another killer on the loose, as Karen's murder had matched the other unsolved murders in the area. The judge denied the request. An investigator on the case implored the judge to reconsider and asked that local law enforcement be given time to investigate the unsolved murders that had similar MOs to Karen's, even though police resources might be limited. The investigator shared what the police told him. They were, quote, too busy to compare physical evidence from many crime scenes. They were understaffed and overworked. The judge did not waver. Perhaps if he did, Walter's next murders may not have even happened. Curtis McCoy was found not guilty by a jury of his peers. Despite the verdict, he was quickly run out of town by people who were outraged that he got away with murder on a technicality. Walter Ellis would occasionally engage in relationships with women. The relationships were tumultuous, often leading to more legal trouble for Walter. His fights with his girlfriends would often escalate to violence. In November of 1994, he was charged with recklessly endangering safety for stabbing his then-girlfriend, Ethel Hardman, with a screwdriver. The charges were later dismissed. 1995 was Walter's deadliest year on the prowl. He murdered 28-year-old Florence McCormick on April 24th in a vacant house where they most likely had sex. She was later found strangled. In June of that same year, he met and murdered 37-year-old Sheila Ferrier. He left her in a vacant house near the same area he left Florence McCormick. The next murder stands out from the rest of the murders tied to Ellis. 16-year-old Jessica Payne was a drug-addicted teenage runaway. Having just been released from jail the day before for fighting, she ended up in a drug house in North Milwaukee. She left at some point and met Walter. They had sex, likely in exchange for drugs or money. 3 days later, she was found behind a vacant house, covered by an old dirty mattress in the same vicinity as Florence McCormick and Sheila Ferrier. Her murder didn't fit the rest. Jessica was different from Ellis's other victims. The other women he killed were African American and were known sex workers. Jessica was Caucasian and a runaway, not a sex worker. Milwaukee police were anxious to solve the murder of Jessica Payne. They pressured several witnesses to say that 21-year-old Shante Ott had committed the murder. Unfortunately, as a result of this corrupt police work, Ott was charged with the murder of Jessica Payne. He was convicted and sentenced to life in prison. Walter must have felt so lucky at this point. Police resources were inadequate, the idea of a serial killer was laughable, and now two men had been accused and tried for murders he committed, one of them being convicted. Walter was again accused and charged with misdemeanor battery for choking Ethel Hardman until she passed out. Again, Ethel was denied justice because the charges against Walter were dropped due to insufficient evidence. Maybe Walter was worn thin by this point. He didn't want to push his luck and decided to lay low. He had already been questioned in the deaths of several sex workers, but there was no clear evidence tying him to the murders, so he was never considered a serious suspect. In June of 1997, he crossed paths with 41-year-old Joyce Mims. Like his other victims, Ellis murdered Mims and dumped her body in a vacant house, just blocks from his mother's house. In 1998, he strangled 39-year-old Marietta Griffin. Her partially clothed body was found on February 17, 1998, lying amid garbage in a garage near Walter's home. Another man named William Avery would go down for her murder and be sentenced to life in prison. The temper that neighbors said had subsided as he grew older eventually got the best of him. He had ended his relationship with Ethel and had begun a relationship with Karen Thomas. Their relationship was just as tumultuous and violent. He beat Karen over the head with a hammer. She required 52 stitches and staples to close the gaping wound in her head. He was charged with second-degree reckless injury. In a twist, he pled guilty to the charges and was sentenced to 5 years in prison. During this prison stint, he would spend a portion of this time in a Texas prison, where he met Napoleon Clark, a convicted pedophile. Ellis was eventually transferred back to Wisconsin, where he would run into Napoleon again. On January 1st, 2001, all prisoners from the state to the federal level were required to provide a DNA sample due to a new law requiring all convicted felons to have a sample of their DNA on file. A month later, Walter was scheduled to provide his DNA. Was this finally it? Would the DNA he left behind on the women he murdered finally give them justice? No. Walter was able to expose a major flaw in the DNA collection process. When it came time to collect DNA, the prison would have the prisoners line up with their files in their hands as proof of their identity. The files did not contain pictures. When it came time for Walter to get in line, he gave his file to Napoleon Clark and had Clark submit the sample for him. When the sample arrived at the lab, a technician noticed that the sample provided as Walter Ellis was a duplicate. Now I warn you, This next statement may make you furious. The technician informed a supervisor of their findings, but the prison was never contacted. Walter dodged this bullet and was released in July of 2001 without having his DNA in the database. This mistake would cost one more woman her life. Perhaps if the lab had just picked up the phone and called the prison, her life would have been spared. On April 27th, 2007, Withrian Stokes' body was found at a vacant house. She was lying on her back in the living room area of the home. Her jacket and shirt were pulled up, exposing her chest. Her underwear was torn and she had one leg inside of her jeans and the other was exposed. Blood had pooled around her legs and a pepper spray canister was found near her body. Crime scene technicians later found blood smeared on the canister and it did not match Withrian. To me, this means that she likely put up a fight. She had contusions on her face, mouth, and neck. She had clearly been strangled. DNA ultimately proved to be Walter's downfall. A comparison of DNA found at crime scenes was examined and Milwaukee police noticed that the same exact DNA profile was found at the crime scene of 8 murdered women. They created a task force to investigate these unsolved murders that were committed by the same man. In May of 2009, authorities announced their discovery and that the murders spanned from 1986 to 2007. The discovery of this DNA evidence also meant that Shante Ott, who was convicted for the murder of Jessica Payne, and William Avery, who was convicted for the murder of Marietta Griffith, were both eventually exonerated and released. Law enforcement received over 190 tips related to the deaths of these 8 women. One man's name came up over and over again, Walter Ellis. On August 29th, a search warrant was executed at his duplex. They confiscated a toothbrush and some razors that belonged to and were exclusively used by Walter. The state lab confirmed that he was a genetic match to the semen that was left on the bodies of all 8 women: Deborah Harris, Tanya Miller, Irene Smith, Florence McCormick, Sheila Ferrier, Jessica Payne, Joyce Mims, Withrian Stokes, and Marietta Griffith. Walter Ellis was arrested on September 7th, 2009, at the Park Motel.
Good afternoon. Thank you for coming here today on Labor Day. I'm joined by District Attorney John Chisholm, Mayor Thomas Barrett, Attorney General J.B. Van Hollen, and members of the Milwaukee Cold Case Homicide Task Force. We're announcing today the culmination of the labors of many people in many agencies, with the arrest of a person we've linked to the homicides of 9 women over a 21-year period. His name is Walter Ellis, aged 49. We're requesting that you not use his photograph, as we still have to do possible witness identifications. Good police work and good police science have led us to Walter Ellis. The Milwaukee Police Department Homicide Task Force unit was announced on May 18th. But these homicides, some more than 20 years old, were never forgotten by the Milwaukee Police Department. We offer our condolences to surviving family members with the hope that today's news gives them confidence there will be justice to mitigate the pain of their loss. Many tools were used to develop suspects. Analysts at the Wisconsin Regional Crime Lab, both the Madison and Milwaukee offices, sifted through years of resubmitted DNA evidence. These samples were provided by our task force. As the technology evolved, the results improved. Through their work and the work of Homicide Task Force members, we have cleared 3 other homicides not linked to this serial set of cases. In the past 2 weeks, we identified 2 additional homicide victims linked by the same DNA profile of the previous 7 we told you about in May. Irene Smith, age 25, was killed in 1992. Karen Kilpatrick, age 32, was killed in 1994. Both were strangled. This makes 9 homicides of women who were linked with the same DNA profile found at the crime scene. Now, it's important to note that this DNA profile did not turn up in any national databases, so it is not linked to any other unsolved murders in other states at this time. In Wisconsin, DNA collection was mandated for all incarcerated felons in 2000. Ellis, our suspect, was incarcerated for a felony in 1998 and was released in 2001, and therefore was not in our database. This search was about shoe leather and science. Over 700 names were contained in the 9 homicide files. We researched 15,000 sexual assault cases spanning 23 years. About 6,000 prostitution-related investigations and arrests were reviewed. 2,000 arrests in the geographic areas where the bodies were discovered were queried over a 15-year period. 1,000 names were queried through the Wisconsin Department of Correction. Searches were conducted in the state DNA data bank of 125,000 people, and 6 million were cross-referenced in national DNA data banks. All pieces of this investigation began to align in the past 2 weeks. The task force had a list of 200 names that were identified as people that we wanted to secure DNA samples from. Milwaukee police detectives were already looking at Ellis very closely based on their investigative leads. Crucial technical assistance was provided by the FBI, which enabled us to narrow a suspect list to a small subset of people, and Ellis's name came up once again, as it had in other searches. A search warrant was conducted for DNA evidence on August 29th at his residence, and that DNA was submitted to the Wisconsin State Crime Lab. On September 4th, we issued a warrant for his arrest after the State Crime Lab returned a result that linked Ellis's DNA to 9 homicides. He was arrested September 5th after Franklin Police Officer Jason Finsel spotted a car that the MPD believed Ellis was using and had issued an alert for. He saw the car in the parking lot of a Franklin motel and notified the MPD. I'm joined by Officer Finsel to my right, and I commend him for his alert and solid police work. And standing next to Officer Finsel, we have the members of the Milwaukee Cold Case Homicide Squad, and I commend them as well for their hard work, dedication, and persistence. Now, you all have in front of you a list of the many agencies that assisted us in this investigation. We're grateful for all of their help, from the State Crime Lab to the FBI to the Marquette University police interns who provided invaluable staff work to our people. Now, we're not announcing the conclusion of this investigation. Rather, we're announcing that a new phase has begun. This means that the work of the Milwaukee Cold Case Homicide Task Force continues in earnest to investigate these deaths, to assist with the prosecution, and to determine if our suspect is linked to any other unsolved homicides. This time, I introduce Milwaukee District Attorney John Chisholm.
Thank you very much, Chief. Last Friday, September 4th, a criminal complaint was issued by my office charging Mr. Walter Ellis with 2 counts of first-degree intentional homicide. The maximum penalty for those offenses is life imprisonment. Count 1 relates to the murder of Ms. Joyce Mims on June 20th of 1997 in the 2900 block of North 5th Street here in the city of Milwaukee. Count 2 relates to the murder of Ms. Wethryn Stokes on April 27th of 2007, that in the 3100 block of North 7th Street. The initial criminal complaint was drafted after extensive investigation by the Milwaukee Police Department resulted in the identification of a suspect. Biological evidence was submitted to the Wisconsin Crime Lab, and the results were returned Friday morning. The complaint was filed, and a warrant was issued by Friday afternoon, and Mr. Ellis was located and arrested by the Franklin and Milwaukee Police Department early Saturday morning. We are now entering a new phase in the investigation and prosecution of this case. We still have a significant amount of work to do, and we intend to bring justice to these victims and to their families. I anticipate that additional charges will be forthcoming in the next day or so. I do want to take the opportunity to thank the members of the task force for the incredible dedication and professionalism that they have shown during this time. I knew that because of who they are and what they have done in the past, that they would bring us to this point. I never had any doubt about that. I'm proud and honored to work with them, and will be proud and honored to continue working with them. I want to in particular thank Lieutenant Keith Baelish. He has led this effort superbly. Detectives Carrasco and Hine are present. They live up to and exceed the often unrealistic demands, and they represent the heart and soul of this investigation. I have some homegrown talent as well. I have Assistant DA Norm Gahn, Mark Williams, who are working very closely to guide this case to a successful conclusion. Again, I anticipate issuing additional charges by the end of this week. And as always, I must remind you that Mr. Ellis is presumed innocent until the conclusion of this case. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We'll now take some questions, understanding, of course, that the degree of specificity we can answer them with is limited by the pending prosecution.
Do you believe that Ellis was knew you were looking for him, that he was hiding out in Franklin, and did he have a gun or any sort of weapon on him?
He was arrested after a struggle, but he did not have his own weapon, and we have reason to believe that he thought we were looking for him because we had, of course, executed a search warrant at his residence and seized evidence that would provide us with comparison DNA.
From the residence after that search?
I'm sorry. Fled is, you know, a word I really can't use. He certainly wasn't there, and he didn't come back. And we subsequently, with the help of the Franklin Police Department, did locate him.
Chief Lynn, what can you tell us about Ellis? Yes, he's arrested in Franklin. It looks like he has a Milwaukee address. He's been in and out of prison, but what kind of lifestyle did he live?
Well, I'm not going to editorialize about his lifestyle. I mean, yes, he does have a criminal history. His criminal history, however, does not lend one to immediately say, you know, prime suspect. But obviously, through a great deal of work analyzing the record as well as the science, we've been able to link him to these locations, and that, I believe, gives the district attorney a strong probable cause to believe we've got the right person.
You were obviously looking for a needle in a haystack here. What was it that finally said, let's move in on Walter Ellis?
Well, without getting too specific, we were able to, identify him through some recent analysis of some of the later crime reports in this series of events. We also had some assistance sifting through mounds of paper information, looking for linkages, connect-ups, and I guess basically a link analysis, if you will. And his name turned up in a few other investigations on the periphery. We began to perhaps see that this is a person we should look into more closely.
There are a number of other prostitute homicides during that period. You suggest that there may be additional cases you're going to continue to search and investigate for that. Are there others that you have ruled him out on? How many have you investigated using his DNA?
Well, all cases in which we had usable DNA gets periodically resubmitted. As the Attorney General pointed out, the science keeps improving. There was a DNA submitted back in the early 90s, and the science was not sufficient working with that size sample DNA to give them useful leads. The science has evolved. So those cases in which we've got usable DNA, we will continue to resubmit periodically, and I suspect there will be continued improvements in the science that may yet lead new leads, develop more leads.
Was there a woman with him when he was arrested, and what was their relation?
Well, you know, we're not going to go into a great deal of detail with it, you know, there was someone else at the scene, and, you know, well, that's about as far as we're going to go right now.
Chief, what, if anything, can you tell us about his alleged motive, why he may have done what he's alleged to have done?
Well, you know, mercifully, as the DA will be the first to say, we don't have to prove motive to prove a crime, and I don't think it's possible for me to speculate what would cause someone to engage in these horrific acts. I can't really supply any logic to it.
Has he confessed to anything?
I'm not going to respond to that.
Is it an indication that he was hiding out at this hotel, or was he meeting someone that day?
You know, again, I'm not going to ascribe motive to why he was there, but he certainly had abandoned his residence, so you can draw your own conclusions.
Do you have a better idea about some of the gaps in time? I know that was one of the questions you guys had, is why did it stop for 6 years and stop again?
Well, as I indicated in my preparatory remarks, you know, what we have to do is continue really investigating what we know and learn more about what we know, and you know, half the job is developing probable cause to make the arrest. The other half of the job is preparing a case that will result in a conviction. So we're certainly not finished with this case.
Can you expand at all on how he knew the victims? Like, I talked to one of the victims' families today, Joyce Mims, and they said that he is a relative of her boyfriend. Have you discovered any other links like that?
We obviously will have to, look more closely. We're aware of that particular, distant relationship. We don't have any objective reason to think that that was a material reason and why the events occurred. But again, the investigation will continue, and we'll still look for additional links and connect-ups.
So right now the link is the prostitution?
That apparently is so, yeah.
Your chart over there talks about a prostitute homicide clearance rate of about 78-79%. How does that compare with the overall victim clearance rate these days?
For the period of time that this is analyzed, it's virtually identical to what the overall clearance rate was in the city. I do know at the time, this history predates any of us being in office. I do know there was some consternation at the time about the perceived departmental effort. The reason we have two maps up there is, number one, when you see the pattern devoid of all the other occurrences, one might say the pattern is obvious. But when you overlay it at the 210 other homicides that took place in the course of 20 years in the same neighborhood, the pattern is less obvious. And I think it's only fair to the department to understand that while this was occurring, Milwaukee was setting records for its homicides. There were over 2,000 homicides in the city while these nine occurred. So, I think the department was stretched, did a solid job, cleared a lot of cases, and cleared a lot of cases of the murders of prostitutes as well.
There's the DNA evidence, obviously, it's been linked to nine victims. Any indication that there may be other homicides that he could possibly be linked to?
We will, as I say, continue to see if there are any other connections.
When news broke that Walter Ellis had been arrested and was suspected in the deaths of at least eight women, his neighborhood was shocked. Family members of the victims were reeling from the idea that their loved one likely knew their killer and that he may have interacted with them at some point. Joyce Mims' son, Purvis, had this to say after learning it was Walter Ellis who might have murdered his mother. "He just seemed like a regular guy. It goes to show you never know what's going on behind closed doors." Purvis Mims said he did not know Walter well, but had met him about six times before his mother was killed. He also revealed one shocking fact. Joyce was dating Walter's uncle at the time. He intimated, "I always thought that she did know the killer because of the environment they found her in. I know she wouldn't have gone in an abandoned house with a stranger, regardless of the circumstances. She probably had a rapport of some kind with him." Walter Ellis was able to expose flaws in the DNA collection process after investigators pieced together why his DNA was not in the system when it was to be collected in 2001. In fact, as a result of this discovery, the Department of Justice and Department of Corrections realized that 12,000 samples from convicted felons were missing from their database. The good news is that the Department of Corrections hired a task force of retired police officers to collect the missing DNA samples. It would eventually lead to the resolution of other crimes. After initially only being charged with two homicides, an additional five murder charges were added by the Milwaukee County District Attorney for the deaths of Deborah Harris, Tanya Miller, Irene Smith, Florence McCormick, and Sheila Ferrier. He was never charged with the murders of Jessica Payne or Marietta Griffith, despite his DNA being found at their murder scenes. He entered a plea of not guilty and remained silent. He refused to work with his court-appointed attorney and was prepared to defend himself. His attorney eventually withdrew from the case. In February of 2011, Walter changed his plea to no contest. He continued to remain silent about his crimes and never offered an explanation as to why he chose to murder. He was convicted and sentenced to seven life sentences without the possibility of parole. Understandably, the family members of the victims offered their statements.
Photographers capturing the final snapshots of a convicted serial killer just before he is sentenced to life in prison without parole. 50-year-old Walter Ellis of Milwaukee pled no contest in the murders of seven women between 1986 and 2007. All of the victims were strangled.
Why? Something went wrong in his life, man, that he had to kill all these women. What went wrong in his life? Something went wrong in his life when he was a kid for him to kill all these women.
He didn't only kill my sister, he killed my mother. She died of heartbreak. That was her baby girl. She died exactly a year after Sheila was found.
Judge Dennis Semple was moved by the relative's testimony.
The one question I had was why?
Walter Ellis was apparently not moved at all. He offered no words and no answers. Still, the families have satisfaction.
I'm very satisfied. I waited over 15 years for this here. At first, I just thought it was going to be a cold case, but after I got the news that he was captured, you know, I was at every court appearance. This is the day I've been waiting on.
His time in prison was relatively quiet. It wasn't until December 1st, 2013, when he would make headlines for a final time.
Convicted serial killer known as the Northside Strangler has died. 53-year-old Walter Ellis served just 4 years in prison.
An autopsy determined that he had passed from natural causes. There was nothing remarkable about his death. Walter's legacy, if you want to call it that, was not the murders he committed. It was the flaws he exposed in an already questionable system. There were so many opportunities to stop Walter Ellis, yet this man with an elementary education was able to beat the system for 21 years. He wasn't smart or cunning. He was just lucky. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please be sure to subscribe, rate, and review on Apple Podcasts. It really helps us out. You can find us on most social media platforms, Twitter at TCFCPod, Facebook.com/TCFCPodcast. You can also find us on Instagram, TCFC_podcast. And of course, our website is TrueCrimeFanClub.com. If you have an episode request or general suggestion, you can send us an email, tcfcpod@gmail.com. A lot of you have asked where you can send me mail. Well, I have set up an address and it's available on the website, so go check it out. I would like to thank the most recent Patreon supporters and some I might have missed. Deidre E., Belle V., Rachel G., Kristen W., Jennifer K., Allison Horrocks, host of the Strange and Unusual podcast, Laura T., Justin R., Beck E., Michelle W., Tyler and Beck from the Minds of Madness podcast, Nida, Laura S., Samantha B., Nicole A., and Elizabeth G. Welcome to the club. Because of your donations, we have added a content editor and researcher to the team. Thanks to Brittany Martinez for her assistance. Please welcome her to the club. Our music for the show was provided by We Talk of Dreams, who created custom music just for us. Check them out on Twitter, at We Talk of Dreams. I recently started a Facebook group where we can discuss the cases more in depth, like this one. Just search for True Crime Fan Club Discussion Group and one of our mods will add you. While you're waiting for the next episode, check out some of my PodFriend shows, and remember, this kind of horror doesn't just happen in the movies. Sleep well, true crime fans.
This week we're discussing the case of the Grim Sleeper.
Tonight we are discussing the wrongful conviction of Richard Rosario.
We're going to talk about the disappearance of Evelyn Hernandez.
We will be discussing the case of the San Mateo Slasher.
Dive into the disappearance of Sneha Phillip.
The wrongful conviction and near execution of Clarence Brantley.
Welcome to Misconduct, a true crime podcast. I'm Eileen, and with me as always is Colleen.
Join us every Thursday as we discuss resolved and unresolved crimes, wrongful convictions, and miscarriages of justice. Find out more at misconductpodcast.com.
Hey, it's Erin.
And this is Jordan.
Each week, we dig up the facts on fascinating felonies.
And mesmerizing misdemeanors.
Join us as we prove that you don't have to know too much about the legal system to be crazy for a good true crime story.
Subscribe to Crime Crazy on iTunes or your favorite podcast app.
And visit us at crimecrazypodcast.com.
He doesn't even go here.
Testing. Can anyone hear me?
My name is Toby, and I'm the host of the Secret Transmission Podcast. We are a show that discusses the paranormal, conspiracies, the supernatural, UFOs, cryptozoology, and anything else weird. Our show is transmitted to iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and YouTube. You can also follow us on Twitter for updates, at Secret Transpod. So get ready to put on your tinfoil hats and come learn with us as we try to explain the unexplainable.
The Boob Tube Buddies are a group of men and women dedicated to bringing class to post-episode discussions of your favorite shows.
Whips, chains, he was up for anything. So he put on his patent black leather gloves and went to the party. Little did he know, there was no party. It was an elementary school and it was 11 a.m.
Thoroughly examining all the angles.
Man, Jurassic Park 3 was a real piece of s***.
But it had Philliam H. Muffman in it.
Who's Philliam H. Muffman? Did you just have a stroke when you said that name?
Sophistication and congeniality above all else.
That's how I feel every time I'm here, because she literally podcasts with her naked butt in my face the entire time. And I just really fell for Audrey at that moment.
I don't, but it wouldn't be surprising if I did, as I love to shock people with my nude body.
Don't be caught with your trousers down at the tea caddy the next morning.
Jerking uncontrollably, and Claire pulls him out.
That's what Mothman does after he gets off the podcast.
Just jerk uncontrollably. To the sound of our own voices.
Oh, God.
Oh, God. God.
I fucking love post-editing.
The Boob Tube Buddies are currently covering Fargo, Better Call Saul, Sense8, and American Gods. You can follow them on all social media sites. Their entire archive is available at boobtubebuddies.com, or you can find them on any podcasting app. Stay classy, little buddies.